And you find depicted here on the screen actually scenes from three different days. Now, the first picture you see is Jesus riding into Jerusalem upon the foal of an ass, and he's received wonderfully. Palm branches strewn in his way, people happy. They received him as king with shouts of Hosanna. Now, interestingly, as triumphant as that day seemed, when he came into Jerusalem on that day, he actually had something else on his mind. He had on his mind his approaching death. You find that in John, the 12th chapter. And in verse 20, it says, there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast. And Philip came. And they asked Philip, sir, we would like to see Jesus. And Philip reported this to Jesus. And oddly, Jesus' response in verse 23 is, the hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it stand abideth alone. But if it die, it brings forth much fruit. Now that goes on all the way through verse 34. Jesus speaking about his approaching death. Now I think the reason Jesus focused on his death on this day of triumph was because he recognized the day. It was the 10th of Nisan. And the 10th of Nisan is the day that Israel was to select their Passover lamb to be killed 4 days later. And he recognized he was going to die in just a few days, and that this grand entrance was like appointing him as the lamb of choice that was going to die soon. Now, on the 14th day of Nisan, of course, Jesus died. And that also was according to type and prophecy. And Jesus was the Passover lamb. And those lambs were to be killed on the 14th day of Nisan. But between those two, there were days of activity and service and zeal that consumes much of the gospel accounts. Now, the gospels focus on the latter part of Jesus' ministry, more than the early part, more than the middle part. Of course, it's comprehensive. But you have much more detail about the last days of Jesus than you do about the earlier days that Jesus experienced. Now, we're going to review the testimony of the Gospels, and we're going to look at the Gospels themselves for a moment to get an idea of how the Gospels differ in their respective testimonies. And when you look at the Gospels, of course, there are four of them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I think that these were presented in Scripture for us the way we have them, because that's the way they were composed. And we'll get more on that in just a moment. But Matthew was the first. Matthew wrote in the Hebrew language. Now, that's odd, because if you look in a diaglot, you're going to see Greek. But all of the early Christian writers who wrote on the subject, who mentioned the point, shared the view that Matthew was originally written in Hebrew. That would jibe with the fact that he was early and first. He was writing to his Jewish audience that were coming into Christ, you know, before Gentiles did. And Matthew arranges his gospel in five sermons. You have the Sermon on the Mount. That's in chapter 5. It goes on for some chapters. And then you have Jesus sending out the disciples to serve, and that's in the 10th chapter. And then in chapter 13, you have seven parables of the kingdom. And then in chapter 18, you have exhortations about Christian living. And then in Matthew 24, we get to that, you know, and spend some time there later, you have our Lord's great prophecy. So there are five sermons, dissertations, as it were, that Matthew constructs his book around. And that probably is because he recognizes Jesus as the greater than Moses, who left for us five books, Genesis through Deuteronomy. Matthew also starts with a genealogy, but he starts with a genealogy from Abraham, because it's important for him to show his Hebrew brethren that Jesus is the seed of Abraham. And then he connects it through David, and then through the carrying away of the captivity, and then forward to the birth of Jesus himself. Now, in that genealogy, you may remember that he accentuates 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the carrying away of captivity, and 14 thereafter to the birth of Jesus. That 14 is not random. It's if you look at the details, Matthew actually forces it to come out to 14, 14, 14. And the reason for that is, of course, writing in Hebrew, the number of the name David, D-V-D, letters 4, 6, and 4 in the Hebrew alphabet totals to 14. That only makes sense, of course, when you're reading in Hebrew. Greek doesn't work that way. So the last point that we have on the screen there is that it was written in Hebrew. How it got into Greek? Presumably it was by Matthew himself. I have read commentaries on things too deep for me to understand, but because I'm not good in different languages. But they say that the Greek of Matthew does not appear to be to show the signs of translation, suggesting that perhaps Matthew himself put it back from Hebrew into Greek. We go on to Mark. Mark is the next gospel in sequence that we have. And it's generally recognized that Mark was essentially Peter's gospel in the sense that Peter was the firsthand witness that observed many of these things that Mark wrote. Now, Mark was the firsthand witness for some notable event, and that was in the Garden of Gethsemane. Probably it was Mark who recorded the words of our Lord's Prayer while Jesus' closest three disciples, being overcome with difficulty and with tiredness, were sleeping. But there was a young man in that garden who was anxious to hear and see what was going on, and that was John Mark. And John tends to be briefer than Matthew and clearer. Now, we'll see that as we get into the last days of Jesus, that Matthew sometimes gives you an account of things comprehensively, but does not always distinguish the days. And Mark is clearer in distinguishing the days. Now, there is in Mark, the 16th chapter, the last portion of Mark, a section that we commonly recognize as spurious. That was added to the Gospel of Mark. Now, not only do the testimony of other manuscripts suggest that, but there's something else that tells you that that part in Mark 16 was indeed spurious. And that is, it simply has a glaring mistake in the passage. You see this in Mark 16, verse 9, where the spurious part begins. It says, "Now when Jesus was risen early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven devils." But in fact, if you look carefully at the other gospels in the book of Matthew, you find out that it was all of the women at the tomb that ran back after they heard from the angel that Jesus was raised. And en route, Jesus appeared to them, plural. But Mary Magdalene clearly was not there at that on that occasion because she had not yet seen Jesus when she returned to the tomb a second time. So Mary, apparently being younger than the other women, we can tell that by the generations involved, apparently outran the others, was not there when Jesus appeared, and Jesus appeared to the other women on their way back from the tomb before Mary, which was the second visit to the tomb. So that's just a mistake in Mark 16:9. And that's testimony that Mark 16:9 to the end is really indeed spurious, as often considered. Luke varies. Luke came later. Luke says that he compiled his gospel from firsthand witnesses. Now, Luke, as you know, was a Gentile. He was not Jew, a Jewish man. So how did Luke, as a Gentile, have insight to write a narrative of the things that Jesus said and did? Well, I think it's because Luke was the companion of Paul. And after his third missionary tour, that's quite late in Paul's experiences, Paul was apprehended in Jerusalem for his own safety. He was conveyed then from Jerusalem to Caesarea, and he was kept there in jail for 2 years. So what did his companion Luke do during those 2 years when his mentor was captive? Well, I think that was the 2 years in which Luke researched for many independent and firsthand witnesses to narrate the sequence of things in Jesus' ministry. And you find this in Luke, the first chapter, verse 3, that Luke is writing to somebody called Theophilus, and he says, I'm going to write in order. Now that word in order in some versions is in sequence. And therefore we have in Luke the most sequential of the four gospels. Mark does clarify the Matthew's order on some occasions, but not always. And the next point we have on the screen there is that it was for Gentiles. And therefore when Luke also gives the genealogy of Jesus, only Matthew and Luke do that. Luke starts not from Abraham, but he goes back to our common roots in Adam, where all Gentiles can appreciate the connection. And he proceeds from Adam forward. And the other thing about Luke, because he is sequential and very careful, is that sometimes narratives that we're very familiar with from the book of Matthew, as a unified, cohesive area, like the Sermon on the Mount or Matthew 24, in Luke are broken into the different accounts in which those pieces actually occurred. So, for example, on the screen we have Luke 12, Luke 17, and Luke 21. Those are the three parts that are joined together in Matthew 24 in the Lord's great prophecy. If it wasn't for Luke's narrative, you wouldn't know that Matthew 24 really comes from three different occasions, but they've been assembled topically, as Matthew does, because they're related. Now, each of them has done a service for us in this respect. Luke has segregated them sequentially in different occasions, but by Matthew combining them topically, an apostle writing this, it actually helps us to see connections that we might have missed otherwise. We go on to the Gospel of John, and John was writing with a message on his heart. John lived later than all of the other gospel writers. He wrote probably after all of the others had passed into the sleep of death. That's why late in his book, in his gospel, he could comment on how it was that Peter met his final testimony of martyrdom. And Gnosticism was a problem when John was writing. Now, I think Gnosticism was a dire problem to Christianity because it struck at the very root of Christian doctrine. That is that Jesus died for our sin. And Gnosticism was a theory that said that the one you knew as Jesus was really not the anointed from above. He was not preexistent. He was possibly an apparition or at most a poor man upon whom the Spirit came, but then departed before he died. Gnosticism undercut the whole point of Jesus being the Redeemer for our sin. And so in the Gospel of John, when you start out, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was not with, but toward God. And the Word also was a God. John is trying to emphasize those things which strike at the heart of Gnosticism to show that was an error. You'll find the same thing in the first epistle of John. Now, it's John's gospel that we can use to actually structure the 3.5 years of Jesus' ministry even better than the sequential gospel of Luke, because John also is sequential, but John mentions every Passover of Jesus' life, that is, of his ministry, excuse me. He mentions the first Passover in John chapter 2, certainly the last one that Jesus died at, and the feeding of the 5,000, just about a year before Jesus died, happened shortly around the Passover season. Now, there is one Passover that possibly John omits, and that's in John, the fifth chapter. And this is what it says, John 5, verse 1. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. If that feast was a Passover, then we have every Passover of his ministry marked, and we're able to distinguish the years and the events by the years accordingly. But if that's not a Passover, and it may not be, then most would assume, I think correctly, or deduce, I should say, that that was the Feast of Purim that was just 1 month before Passover. So effectively, whether it's Passover or Purim, you still have every spring season, effectively, recorded in Jesus' career. So that John is the way that you actually map out Jesus' experiences if you want to write a harmony of the evangelists. And then John. John is the one that really gives us more details than anybody else about Jesus' tender help and care for the saints in his last days. John chapters 13 through 18, just go chapter by chapter, experience by experience in the closing day of Jesus' life with the disciples, and shows his tender care. Now, there are things in John the 14th chapter that I would gloss over if it weren't for brethren bringing it to my attention. But in John the 14th chapter, you all will remember in the early verses, Jesus says to his gathered disciples at the Last Supper, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also." Now, there's a lot about this that was mystifying to the disciples. First, though they were told point blank, they still hadn't apprehended that Jesus was leaving, that he was going to die and go away. I don't think the apostles even really understood, not yet, the distinction between the heavenly call and the earthly kingdom. Because, you know, as Jesus approached Jerusalem in the last week of his life, in Luke, the 19th chapter, because he realized they expected the kingdom soon to appear, he took the time to give them a parable explaining how a king must go into a far country to receive a kingdom and later to return. All of this, I think, became clear to them after Jesus' resurrection and by his instruction in the 40 days that he was with them. But on this occasion, John 14, there's something here quite precious that I was not always aware of. Jesus is speaking to them as a bridegroom would speak to an intended bride. Now, when he says in verse 2, "In my Father's house are many mansions, if it were not so, I would have told you. But I go to prepare a place for you." He's talking about the custom of a bridegroom. If he had the agreement of his bride-to-be to marry him, then no matter how rich his father was, he would return to his father's home. He would build onto that home a new area just for his new budding family, then come back at an unknown time, whenever he was ready and complete, to receive his bride and take her where he would be. Now, I don't know if they got the point of the custom when he was speaking or not. But when a young man would propose to a young bride to be, proposal of marriage, he would pass her in Jewish custom a cup of wine. And if she took that cup, her answer was yes. Now, in this Last Supper, they had all received a cup of wine. They had all taken that cup of wine. They had all agreed to receive the benefit of our Lord Jesus. And they had all agreed to be with him in whatever experiences would follow. So Jesus is putting on this, the construction of his invitation to them and through them to us all, to be part of his bride class, and that he would come at an unknown time and claim his bride. And now, of course, he has returned. He has claimed those members that were from long ago, and he's now gathering one by one as the bride completes their course in death, the bride class. So when you get to the parable of the wise and foolish virgins, that's predicated upon the same custom. But now he's returning to take his bride. But we'll pass on from there. Those are the four gospel narratives. And in that sequence, now I should mention, by the way, about a sequence. Sometimes there is in commentaries the view that maybe Mark was before the others. I might just add this point from McClintock and Strong's. Quote, "There is much in favor of the opinion that their usual position, that is, as we have them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, arose from regard to the chronological dates of their respective composition of the four Gospels. This is the opinion of, not modern ones, but Origen, Irenaeus, and Eusebius. All ancient testimonies agree that Matthew was the earliest and John was the latest." Now, it is true that some older sources swap the order of Luke and Mark. But three very good sources have it just the way we have it, and I think this actually makes sense. If you look in John's gospel, you're going to see the word love more than any, that word appears in any other gospel. That makes sense to all of us because John was the one that even in his epistle accentuated the grace and quality of love. Luke mentions the word wisdom more than any other gospel writer. And in Luke 11th chapter, verse 49, he says, therefore also said the wisdom of God. I think that's his name for Jesus. I will send them prophets and apostles, and some they shall slay and persecute. The word gospel appears in Mark more than any other of the four gospels, and the word king overwhelmingly appears in Matthew, I think like 95 times more than any other gospel. That might give you just a clue for the approach mentally that each one was taking in their gospel account. Now, we talk about the four gospels, and I think those four gospels are the source for the river of life that really is the message of redemption and salvation and deliverance for everyone, starting with the gospel age church and then on to the kingdom. Now, you find this in Revelation, the 22nd chapter, that there's a river of life that flows out from the throne of God and of the Lamb. Now, that'll be in the kingdom. But already, you know, like Psalm, is it 45, 49, says there is a river that makes glad the city of God. So we already have access to the streams of truth before it is a river of life for the world and mankind in the kingdom. And noticing that with the river of life in Eden that people were debarred from, but symbolically returned to later in the kingdom, noting that there were four tributaries to that river of Eden, some do wonder whether maybe the four gospels antitypically are the four tributaries to the river of life that constitute the testimony of the life and service of our Lord Jesus. Well, perhaps so. Perhaps so. Now, we have in Eden, we have the four names. We have the Pison that went through the land where there's a lot of gold. Now, that river you see on the screen there, the Pison, really is not a flowing river today. And that's why it's not frequently identified. But people who have studied ancient riverbeds suggest that there was a river, a cogent river, that was there 2,500 or 3,000 years ago that connects with the country that today we call Kuwait, right about as this shows it. And there is gold in this part of Saudi Arabia. And this river does flow out to the area of gold, so, and the area of Pavlos. So that could be. The river Gihon, there is a river Karun that many think might be that river of Gihon. Now, that river of Gihon is not, the Karun is not shown properly on this map, but it's the only one I could find to show it well. But if you look here on the smaller map, there's that river Karun, and it really is goes a little bit more northward. And as it turns out, this also, between here and between the Caspian Sea, there is gold in this area of Iran. So it's possible even that Pison and Karun have been switched here. I don't want to get too technical here in that point, but just mention then that there's the Hiddekel, which is really the Tigris River, and then there is by name the Euphrates. So maybe these are the four gospel tributaries that make up the one unified testimony of Jesus' life. Now, other brethren have suggested maybe these are four classes. That possibly stems from the thought that these might be four divisions of the river of Eden that flow after Eden. Well, that can't be because they're really tributaries. That's the way rivers work. But still, it might be that these are connected with four classes. The very fact that one of them goes to an area where there's gold does tend to link it to the church class, the divine. And then one that encompasses the land of Cush might be the great company. And then the Tigris, well, that might be Israel or the ancient worthies, and the Euphrates, or the whole world of mankind, the river Euphrates. So perhaps there's something there. Personally, I like the four rivers as four gospels. But maybe there's both thoughts involved here. Now we're going to look quickly at Jesus' last days, that is the last week, and then we're going to focus in on Wednesday, the 12th of Nisan. Now this testimony begins in John, the 12th chapter. with Jesus' approach to Bethany. Now here it is, John 12, verse 1. Then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he, Jesus, raised from the dead. Now, when it mentions Passover, we know, of course, that the Passover lambs were killed on the 14th day, and Jesus died on the 14th day. But if you ask today any Jewish person what day is Passover, they always acknowledge it as day number 15, because they would eat the Passover lamb early on the 15th day after it had been slain on the 14th. And of course, today they don't use Passover lambs. And so today, by all means, the feast is on the 15th. But I think even in ancient times, that was the day. So when Jesus, it was said to be coming to Bethany 6 days before Passover, if you start that count on the 15th day and you go back 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 days, you get to the 9th of Nisan. And the day of the week that would be a Sunday. Well, now this makes sense as well, because where did Jesus come from to approach to Bethany? He came from Jericho, and Jericho to Bethany would be a long distance. He would not be doing that, for example, on the previous day, which would be a Saturday, where it was Jewish custom to not travel more than, quote, a Sabbath day's journey of about a mile or so in our terms. So I think that this all makes sense, that he did that travel on Sunday. Now, if you go back to look at the experience of where Jesus was before he came to Bethany for his last experiences, well, you have to turn to the Gospel of John again. John is the only one that really mentions this buildup towards his last visit to Jerusalem. If you go to John, the 10th chapter, verse 22, we read this, the only one that mentions this, the only gospel, and it was at Jerusalem, the Feast of Dedication, and it was winter. Now, that's when Jesus visited Jerusalem, not the last time, but the second of the last time. Even then, there's some doubt here. But the Feast of Dedication is the feast that we know better as Hanukkah. And as you all know, that's in December. So that would be a winter feast. Now, in this experience, if you read John 10, verse 12, verse 22, verse by verse, you'll see that there was a contentious difficulty between Jesus and the scribes and Pharisees. And they were ready to pick up stones and kill him. So he had to leave. And so where did he go? Well, where he went was Ephraim. The only time Ephraim is mentioned in the Gospels as a location where Jesus visited is John, the 11th chapter, and that's, I'm ahead of myself here a little bit. What Jesus went to after this encounter was he went beyond Jordan, where John the Baptist had been preaching originally. Now, this is John, the 10th chapter, verse 40. And he went away again beyond Jordan into the place where John had first baptized, and there he abode. And many resorted unto him and said, well, John didn't do any miracle, but look what this man does. And many believed on him there. So even in these last weeks and months before his Passover visit to Jerusalem, Jesus was having a very profitable ministry. Now, after that, he heard that Lazarus was sick. And in the 11th chapter of John, you have his return to the Bethany area and his healing of Lazarus. But that didn't maintain, because the people who deposed Jesus were so upset at just about everything he did. The very fact that he raised Lazarus from the dead, they said, this man has to die. He's getting too popular. And so in John, the 11th chapter, in verse 49, one of them named Caiaphas, you know who he is, being the high priest that same year, said, you know, this man has to die. One man should die for the people, that the whole nation perish not. And verse 51, John says, because Caiaphas was a high priest, he actually spoke that prophetically, because it is true. Jesus needed to die for the whole nation, not in the way Caiaphas thought, but it is true. So Jesus had to leave then. And then in verse 54, we read, Jesus therefore walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence into a country near to the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. And that's where he was until his last journey to Jerusalem again. Now, no other gospel mentions Ephraim. So where is Ephraim? Ephraim, you know, we often hear that Jesus went to Galilee in the north, and that's where he spent much of his ministry. He was from Galilee in the Nazareth area. Ephraim is like halfway between Jerusalem and Galilee. And only in this account, and apparently only in this last experiences of Jesus' life, did he visit there and do extensive ministry there in the area of Ephraim. And then, as Luke records, but not John, Luke, the 19th chapter, Jesus then went on his way to Jerusalem through Jericho. And that's where he met Zacchaeus up in the tree. And he said to Zacchaeus, you come down, and this day salvation has come to thy home. And then Jesus said, I'm going to abide at your home tonight. Now, Jesus, of course, could read the heart, and he knew Zacchaeus would be thrilled by that offer. But the point is that Jesus stayed with his retinue at the home of Zacchaeus that night. And then the next thing we have record of is he's on his way to Bethany. And I think it was from Jericho that Jesus came to Bethany, and he would not have done that on Saturday, on a Sabbath. I think that's when he was resting at Zacchaeus' home, and therefore John, the 12th chapter, verse 1, 6 days later, 6 days before Passover, is Sunday, not Saturday, but Sunday. And that night, of course, you know that Jesus was anointed by Mary on his feet. And while all the other disciples were clamoring about the expense, prompted by Judas, who kept the bag, Jesus said, she has done this against the day of my burying. Jesus knew that was only days ahead. Now, that was the evening of Sunday, as we would count it. But by Jewish count, that was turning into the 10th day of Nisan, when he is anointed for his approaching death. So this day is meaningful numerically as the 10th of Nisan. 10th of Nisan. So now we get to John, the 12th chapter, verse 12. On the next day, much people that were come to the feast of Passover, when they heard that Jesus was coming, well, they received him, took palm branches, and they welcomed into the city with great fanfare. Now, in John, the 12th chapter, we realize, as we mentioned earlier, this is the day of triumph, but the day that Jesus recognizes as the day when he is going to prepare for his death. He's being received triumphantly on Monday morning as the 10th day of Nisan, as the appointed lamb that is soon to die. Now, we pick up the narrative from here, from John, in the Gospel of Matthew and in the Gospel of Mark, because they itemize the affairs more pointedly. And in Matthew, the 21st chapter, verse 12, on this day when Jesus entered into Jerusalem, this is what Matthew says happened. It says, Matthew 21:12, Jesus went into the temple of God and cast out them that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves. And he said, my house will not be called a den of thieves. It's supposed to be a house of prayer. Well, Mark clarifies better in Mark, the 11th chapter, verses 13 and 15, that there was a distinction of days. The day that Jesus rode into Jerusalem was acclaimed king was the day that he saw what was going on in the temple, but not the day that Jesus acted. Now, we find this in Mark 11, verse 11. Mark 11, 11, Jesus entered into the temple of Jerusalem, and he looked round about upon all things, and he didn't do anything about it. Now, when eventide was come, he went to Bethany with the 12. Now, the point of interest here is that Jesus did not do this in a moment of anger and rage. It wasn't a spontaneous emotional outburst. Jesus saw what was going on, went back to Bethany. Surely he contemplated the issue that night and determined what his responsibility would be. And then Jesus came in the morning prepared to act. Now on that morning, we find in the 11th chapter of Mark, verse 12. On the morrow when they were come from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree afar off having leaves, he came, if haply he might find anything thereon. When he came, you know the story, he found nothing but leaves, for the time of figs was not yet. Now it always bothered me why Jesus would look for fruit when there wasn't time for fruit. But of course, there's a little mystery here. The fig tree actually can have fruit that early. And that fruit is the early crop. And that early crop is larger, each individual fig, than a normal crop of figs. But there's not as many of them. Now, we actually have a fig tree in our backyard. Some years we witness that. We witness very large figs, but few in number that come out in the spring. But in August is when the big crop comes, smaller individually, but much more prolific. Pardon me. So I think Jesus was thinking there could possibly be some good fruits there. And I think that represents that at the first Advent, there was no substantial fruitage from Jesus' efforts. Now, there were Jews that did believe that that is true. But as a nation, they did not. And I think that was the point of his lesson. They had leaves of profession, but they did not bear the fruitage that was anticipated. He cursed that tree. It wouldn't be till the next morning they see the results, but he cursed it. And then it says in verse 15, they came to Jerusalem and Jesus went into the temple and began to cast them out that bought and sold and overthrew the tables of the money changers. Jesus now had a purpose. He had deliberated already. He knew what he was going to do. He cursed the fig tree, incidentally, but he went then on his purpose and cast out the money changers, not in a fit of rage, but in a deliberate campaign to do what he thought his duty and responsibilities were to do. Now, the next day, we get into Wednesday, the 12th of Nisan, the day of Jesus' ministry in which more is recorded, perhaps, than any other day. On Wednesday, when he came back into the city, you can imagine what the scribes and Pharisees would have been prepared to do, and that is to confront him. And that's what they did. In Mark, the 11th chapter, verse 20, in the morning, that would be the next morning, Wednesday, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots, and they marveled. Whoa, that's something we wouldn't have thought. And in verse 27, when they come again to Jerusalem, as he was walking in the temple, there come to him the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. They're loaded. They're loaded with questions. What authority do you have to have done the things that you're doing? I can understand the reason for their concern. On the other hand, they missed the whole point. They missed the whole point that this was just and righteous. That's not what bothered them. What bothered them was that he did something against their authority. And so they're going to attack him. Now, this is a day of great confrontation. And it's also a day of great testimony, even prophetically. We'll get into that later. We'll come back to this day and spend some time on it. Thursday, when Jesus left, on Wednesday, he did not return on Thursday morning. He stayed at Bethany, and there until the evening, or late afternoon perhaps, he sent the disciples to prepare for the Last Supper. Now, other brethren have mentioned something that had escaped my attention. You know the story. You know that he told them, go into the city. You're going to see a man carrying a pot of water. Go where he goes, and then you're going to have a place prepared for you. And you can tell the master, yes, the master needs this place, and it's going to be prepared for our gathering. All of this is quite odd. But, of course, I think he's telling them this because the place was unknown. And he didn't want the place to be known ahead of time because he didn't want anything to interfere with the Last Supper occasion, for instance, with Judas reporting his location somewhere. So Judas had no way of knowing the location until he actually arrived there. And he was not able to schedule anybody to come and interrupt or apprehend Jesus. I think that's meaningful. On Friday, of course, Jesus was tried He was first arrested, of course, in the Garden of Gethsemane early on Friday, according to the Jewish count. He was tried. He was crucified. And according to Exodus, the 12th chapter, verse 6, he died that day on the 14th of Nisan. And in Numbers 28, you find more information listing the particulars of the Passover death of the lamb and the various things associated with it. So the 14th is the day Jesus died. Jesus on the 15th day, of course, would be on Saturday resting on the Sabbath in the tomb. And finally, on Sunday, he was raised to life with glory, honor, and immortality. Now, on the 16th day when he was raised, that does connect prophetically with the time that after the Passover, 2 days after the Passover, when they killed the lamb on the 14th day, on the 15th day they had their feast, and on the 16th day they were to wave the first crop of their harvest, which would be barley. They would wave the barley sheaf on the 16th day of Nisan. You find that in Leviticus 23, verse 11. And then Paul comments on that. Paul made the connection. The day Jesus raised from the tomb is the day they wave the first fruit of their harvest. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, 20, Jesus was raised from the dead and has become the first fruit from the dead. And I think he's connecting the point that that waving of the first fruit is a picture of Jesus on that day. Now, it's interesting that on most Jewish days of note in their festivals, they were said to have a holy convocation, but not on this day of waving the first fruit. No holy convocation was scheduled. Now, I passed that by for a long time, but I think it was Brother Harry Wildblood gave a talk at the Los Angeles Convention, in which he put a point to that. I've always appreciated it since then. The point of no convocation is that there was no gathering in anticipation and expectation. And that's the way it was on the day Jesus was raised from the tomb. Nobody expected him back. Now, it is true that remember Jesus said something about the third day. But when the women went to the tomb, they were to anoint him, you know, with the spices. It was nothing about anticipating resurrection. So there was no gathering to receive Jesus the day he was raised. No holy convocation. Took everybody by very pleasant surprise. Now that's the end of those days. We're going to go back now and look at Wednesday, Nisan the 12th in particular. Now we've talked about the fact that the fig tree was dry. We're going to go back a little bit to Matthew the 21st chapter. And see how many things are recorded for us on Wednesday, the 21st. Now, this was the last day of Jesus' public ministry. And Jesus went out, you know, with a proverbial bang, not a whimper. We have so much recorded on this last day. It must have been a very tiring day. Now, remember, Wednesday is when they saw the fig tree dried. Jesus made a lesson of that. And then it was the day that began with confrontation. Now, in Matthew, the 21st chapter, after he's passed by the fig tree and saw that, and there's confrontation when the priest and the people are going to be opposing him. We read that earlier. Now Jesus starts a series of teachings. And in Matthew, the 21st chapter, verse 28, he gave a parable about two sons that were admonished by their father to go and work in the field. And the first one says, sure, I'll go. But he didn't. And the second one said, no, I'm sorry, I defer to go. But he thought about it later and he went. And this was a lesson to the scribes and Pharisees and the leaders that though they claim to be ready to go in the service of God, in fact, they don't really do it. And the publicans and the sinners that he said would come into the kingdom before you, well, they weren't really religiously minded as much. And yet when Jesus appeared, they received him. They were more receptive and more ready to enter into the work that the Heavenly Father had for them. than the scribes and Pharisees. That's the lesson of that parable. In Matthew, the 21st chapter, verse 33, it says, "Hear another parable. A certain householder which planted a vineyard, and he digged a wine press in it, and he built a tower, and he let it out to the husbandmen that went into a far country. And when the time of fruit came near, he sent his servants that they might receive the fruit. And they killed one, his servants, they beat one, killed another, stoned another. So he sent more servants, more than the other, than at the first. And they treated them the same way." And I think this is a picture of how the prophets were sent to Israel to receive the proper reverence and service and respect that God would anticipate for all that he had done for the nation of Israel. And the prophets were sawn asunder, were rejected, some of them killed, some of them received poorly, some of them imprisoned. They weren't respected. And so finally, last of all, he says, "I'm going to send my son. They will reverence my son." But when they saw the husbandmen, when the husbandmen saw the son, they said to themselves, "This is the heir. Let's kill him. Let's seize on his inheritance." They caught him and cast him out of the vineyard and slew him and then took the vineyard. He says, what do you suppose the master is going to do in this case? He's going to kill those people that slew his son and take the vineyard out of their control. Now, this is engaging to me because we know the point of this, of course. But Jesus was effectively telling them, they're going to kill him. He knows that. They know they're plotting it. They don't know exactly how it's going to happen. Jesus does. But Jesus is publicly identifying for any listening here. They will, something they will remember in the aftermath of his death. He knows very well what's going to happen to him. This again was this day, Wednesday, the 12th of Nisan, the last day of his public ministry. Now in the 22nd chapter, verse 1, Jesus answered again, another parable. Excuse me. I should mention back in the 21st chapter, verse 43, Jesus is very explicit. Jesus says, the kingdom of God is going to be taken from you, the scribes and Pharisees, and been given forth to a nation bringing forth the fruits thereof. Now I think there he meant by a nation. Probably he's expanding his thought even to the Gentiles because they would outnumber the Jewish recipients of the high calling as time went by. Whoever will fall on this stone will be broken. But take heed here. Whoever that stone falls on is going to be ground to powder. Now we know prophetically that happens to the image, but it's going to happen to anyone that opposes Jesus prophetically. They sought to lay hands on him. They feared the multitude, so they had to just let him go. Chapter 22, the king that prepared a marriage for his son, and he sent out people to come to the marriage, and they refused. He says, okay, send them out a second time and tell them my oxen and my fatlings have been killed and ready to go. Everything's ready. Tell them to come. I think that represents the fact that Jesus now had died, and prophetically in this parable, and now a second invitation went out. In light of the death and resurrection of Jesus, let's come. But instead, they evil entreated the people that invited them and slew them. And when the king heard that, he sent forth his armies to devastate their land. And that's what happened in 70 AD in the judgment. Now, I can't help but recognize the scribes and Pharisees that heard this would be understanding these are very strong judgment messages against themselves. Now, when you go on to chapter 22, verse 15, we have now where the Herodians, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees, each in turn, are going to accost Jesus with a challenge. You remember they couldn't apprehend him because they feared the crowd, but they can try to deceive, to trick him. And so that's what they're doing here, starting with verse 15. And you remember these three are the three guardians of Israel. The Herodians are the political part. The Sadducees are in charge of the temple. The Pharisees are the respected teachers of the law to the people. Now, way back in Zechariah, the 11th chapter, he says, I will cut off three shepherds in 1 month. And I think those are the three shepherds cut off because of their illicit leadership of Israel. But here, they're trying to stump Jesus. The Herodians come by, the political party. They say, what about tribute? Should we be paying tribute? Well, you can imagine the fix they thought Jesus would be in here, no matter which way he answered. But he said, show me a coin. Whose inscription, whose image is that on the back? Oh, Caesar, you say. Well, then give to Caesar what belongs to him and give to God what belongs to him. Jesus always had an answer. The Sadducees, who didn't believe in the resurrection, asked a perplexing question about a woman who had married to 7 husbands sequentially until they all died. And he says, well, no, you're misapprehending. The time is going to come when circumstances will be different when it comes to marriage and the resurrection. And then in verse 35, the Pharisees now, they come by and one of them is a lawyer. He says, which is the greatest law? And of course, no matter what he would say, they could accuse him of not liking some other law. But Jesus stumped them. He didn't pick one of the 10, although he could have picked the first one. It seemed like a good possibility. But he picked something, not one of the 10 commandments at all. He quoted Deuteronomy and says, you shall love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, soul, and strength. And then he'll venture another one quoted from Leviticus. You will love your neighbor as yourself. Hard to disagree with Jesus' answer on those points. Jesus always had the right answer at the right time. And so Jesus decided, now I'm going to ask you Pharisees a question. You tell me, when David in the Old Testament called the Messiah Lord, how is that the Messiah is the son of David and yet the Lord of David? Well, that stumped them. They're not as clever as Jesus. But of course, the point was that Jesus, as the son of David, was also Messiah. There was a son of David right in their midst. There was no question he was the son of David. That was the end of their questions. You know, when he asked them that question, that stumped them. And when they asked him about his authority, you know, he said, well, you tell me the answer to this question. When John came, what authority did John have to do what he did? And of course, they couldn't answer, because whatever they would say, if they said, well, he had the authority of God, then Jesus would say, well, why didn't you listen to him? And if they said he had no authority, they feared the people. So they just said, well, I can't answer. And so Jesus would say to them, when they pressed him for his authority, well, neither do I answer you. He always had the right response for the right occasion. Now, on this same occasion, this was the time when Jesus left the temple in the end of chapter 23, after Jesus really did rail against the scribes and Pharisees. Starting in chapter 23, verse 13, he gave them 7 woes to the Pharisees. Now, you might count 8 when you go through this passage. But remember that verse 14 is spurious, and you have 7 woes, maybe a parallel to the 7 plagues that would come at the end of the second advent, the gospel age and the second advent harvest. And then Jesus said, you are whited sepulchers, you're a generation of vipers. How can you escape the judgment of Gehenna? I'm going to send prophets and scribes to you. You're going to kill some, crucify some. You'll scourge some. And upon you may come all the righteous blood from Abel to Zechariah, 2 people in the Old Testament that both represented Jesus our Lord. The last Zechariah, not the prophet, but the one that was stoned in the temple because of his fidelity. Jesus said, on your generation, all this will come. So they all left the temple. That's the last closing day of Jesus' public ministry. They go out to the Mount of Olives and the disciples' heads are spinning. When are these things going to be? And when will, as you say, not one stone be left upon another? When is this going to happen? So Matthew 24 is Jesus' lengthy response to that question. And in Matthew 24, we find a double prophecy, not only in response to the end of the Jewish age, but also to the end of the gospel age and his final return. Now, I'd just like to mention, as time is passing here, one point about Matthew 24, verse 30. Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, I just suggest that if you look at that verse and try to determine the exact meaning of that, I would just refer you to the sermon book on page 420. The very second paragraph of that sermon book, page 420, where he distinguishes this is not about the parousia of Christ. This is about the final Epiphania, Bright Shining, or as we might say, the Apocalypse of Christ. Read that paragraph. It's very clear in this point. And I think this helps to elucidate the meaning of Matthew 24 quite a bit. Matthew 24, Jesus' answer from verses 4 down through verse 13 is what's going to happen before the end of the age. Verse 14, then shall the end come. 14 through 28 is the harvest of the end of the age that we're currently in, where the Lord's return is upon us and there is judgment upon Christendom. We're to flee out of spiritual Judea and pray that your flight not be in the wintertime, too late, or on the Sabbath day when the world rests, that's too late. Come out during the harvest. And then in verse 29 and 30, there's the climax of the harvest. Three parts to Jesus' answer. Before the Lord's return, the Lord's return, and the climax. Now, after that, Jesus gives them lessons about his coming return. And there's three lessons he has to say. He says, number one, it's absolutely going to happen. You can take that to the bank. Secondly, nobody's going to know long beforehand the time of its coming. And thirdly, therefore, you had better watch and be alert. And then we move on to Matthew 25, where he gives three parables indicative of the lesson he's expressed. Number one, you should be like virgins waiting for the Lord to return, watching for the day. Secondly, you should be devoted and attentive before the Lord's return. That's the parable of the talents. No matter how many talents they got, the faithful ones doubled them, the unfaithful ones did not. And at his return, the Lord is going to expect results from our service during the age. And finally, in verses 31 to the end, closing out Matthew's account of this last day, is the parable of the sheep and the goats, that there's going to be judgment. Now, I think that parable might be more expansive than we usually consider it. I think there we have judgment not only during the harvest for the saints during the age, but, and then he moves on, and even more directly, judgment for the world of mankind during the kingdom, when at the end of that judgment, there's going to be life and death meted out, even the lake of fire, symbolic of second death. And then in chapter 26, you know that after 2 days is the feast of Passover, and Jesus is finished. He's with his disciples. He has ended his public ministry. And Jesus now finally can rest. Those are the three images we start with. And finally, on Easter morning today, Jesus is alive. He's our King. He's our Master, our Priest, who lives forever. Thank you.